are up to God's speeches. It took us quite a while to get here, but here we are. And I'm going to dedicate for myself my learning in the Shir in memory of Dolev ben Dvorit ve'Eliyahu. For some of you are aware my Beit Midrash has a program to learn before Yom HaZikaron, which is next week, in memory of soldiers who fell or victims of terror. So Dolev Kedar is the soldier in whose memory I am learning, so I'll dedicate my learning for it. If anyone wants to participate in it, the signature file in my email has a flyer in it with the link that you could go to. Or if you want to ask me afterwards, that's fine too. So as I was preparing this and trying to figure out what it is that God wants to tell Job, I had what felt like a certain revelation about what's going on in the book as a whole, which fits with what we've said so far. It's not some revolutionary rewrite of the book. It fits with what we've done so far, but for me, cast it in a very new light, which was that email that I sent out, encouraging people to read Shir HaShirim, Song of Songs, carefully, because I think there's a lot to be said about seeing them as two sides of the same coin. Now, remember where we've been, right? We began the book with Job being a wonderful human being, an example, in fact, for what a human being should be. And we saw Job, basically held up by God as the example for what he wants out of human beings. When the Satan says, people are terrible, they're selfish, they just want for themselves. And the response from God was, no, look at Job, he's different. And Satan said, well, let's see what happens. Let's see what he doesn't get when he's not getting for himself. Then let's see how he does. And Job is subjected to horrible loss, as well as ultimately physical pain. And we then saw his three visitors show up, and we saw the debates that go between them, where the visitors try to convince Job that there is justice in this world. If you're suffering, there is a reason for you to be suffering, whether that reason is punishment for something you've done wrong, or setting you up for something better, or you didn't live up to your potential. All the different ideas that we presented, whereas Job, in response, says, absolutely not. God is not concerned about justice, because if he was concerned about justice, then my experience would be very different. And along with that came the debate of do wicked people suffer. As the text was read by Ralbag, and I think B'tzudat David as well, there was also a discussion, maybe God has outsourced the running of the universe to the stars. And then after that, we saw Job, or apparently it's Job speaking, condemn the whole idea of the wisdom dialogue. Human beings can't achieve wisdom anyway, only God has wisdom. And then we were all set for God to speak, and Elihu jumped in and gave us his messages to Job. You say God doesn't communicate. Of course God communicates. You say there's no justice. Of course there's justice. God is benevolent. He's the one who keeps society in line. He makes sure that the powerful are not able to harm others, and so on. And that brings us to the moment when God is finally going to weigh in and speak in chapter 38, and it'll run us chapter 38 to 41. So, in order to appreciate what is going on and what God wants to express, the first question we need to ask, and I put it on the sheets with item number one, is what do we know about God? Not what do we know about God in general from the Torah, but what do we know about God from this book? What can you tell me based on everything we've read for the last 37 chapters? What can you tell me about God? From the reader of the book getting the information, you can't tell me something that is a personal point of view. In other words, Job says he thinks. What do we actually know objectively from the events in this book? Ralph?
He subscribes to testing man.
Okay, God is a tester of humanity. Potentially, although really it's a response to Satan that he is testing. I think he's concerned with demonstrating the spiritual worth of humanity. He wants to know how good we are, and he's willing to test in order to determine it. Yeah?
Question. Satan an aspect of God?
So the whole question of what these malachim are, you know, do we understand them as aspects of God or as messengers sent by God? In some sense, he has to be a representative of something God wants, or he wouldn't exist.
That's what I'm...
Okay.
Well, you said spiritual. I said it's an aspect of God. You said spiritual.
In which part?
The second you said, the second thing of God, which is spiritual.
No, that I'm not sure that I call him a tester, but he's concerned with the spiritual worth of humanity.
Spiritual worth.
And determining it and demonstrating it. Yes?
He orders nature, and we are part of nature.
He orders nature more than that. He is apparently all-powerful. As seen from the fact that Satan doesn't get to do whatever he wants, right? Satan has to ask God for permission. No one gets to do anything except at God's say-so. Elisha, and then Sharon. Or the other way around. He lets things happen, bad things happen, to good people. Meaning, Job is suffering, and God is, on some level, okay with that.
Yes.
Okay. Yes, Elisha.
He's engaged. That's what we call it, engaged. Not just passive.
Right. He's engaged, although with an apparent layer of intermediaries of some kind. Because God doesn't say one day, I'd like to test Job. It's this being who is expressing something that God must, in some sense, have as part of him, going back to Debbie's point. But yes, God is engaged in the universe. We know that God values the traits for which he praises Job. Right? In chapter 1, sentence 8, he identifies Job as innocent, righteous, revering God, doesn't harm other people. Right? That's what he said to Satan when he wanted to say Job is great. So clearly, God thinks these are traits of greatness.
Is anybody troubled by the fact that this is an extremely disturbing situation? God, all-knowing, all-powerful God, knows that he is a good man. And one of his angels, with whatever agenda, says to God, yeah, try him. And okay. I'll take away everything. I'll punish him. I'll make his life a living hell.
So, I'll refer you back to the recordings from the first few weeks when we looked at this in depth. But the short answer that we gave was that potential for greatness does not equal actual greatness. In other words, what Satan is contending is that human beings are all selfish. And what is needed here is a demonstration that it's not so.
Why is it needed?
Because that's what all of humanity is here for.
But who are we testing and who are we showing this to? God? Us? I mean, the intended audience, if it's for us, yes, but God knows that he's a good man.
In what way does God know until a person does it? If the person doesn't actually carry it out, you know, there's a saying in sports, that's why you play the game, right? Because any given team on any given day can beat any given opponent. You have to actually see it happen. Not just there is potential in him to be good, but a person has to do good.
This was written for us to learn from.
Well, that's the parable.
It wasn't written for God. It was written for us to learn from. And if we're to learn from it, we have to know what we're learning. And it's not entirely obvious to me at this point. I want to hear what God's self has to say about this. But at this point in the development of the story, it's not entirely obvious what the point is.
No, I think the point of why God did it is made in the beginning. In other words, he says very clearly, there is a need to justify the existence of humanity.
But that's a very divine pro attitude.
Yeah.
If you ask most people in the street, I'm not saying people who have studied this book.
Yeah.
But who have gone through things in their life and have some thought of theodicy, it's just a very weak answer for God the Satan.
Why?
Because God is putting us through something that most people do not want to do. And just you can look at it a different way. The entire concept
they
of choice, if you really, if people really said to people, let's have a vote. Do we want choice? Or do we want...
Stop that. He's not to be mentioned.
Or do we want automatic decisions and cancer can be beaten? You know, it's a pretty...
Right, but there you're going to see the response of, who cares what the human being thinks about what the world should be like? The human being didn't create it.
Who cares about what the human being thinks of God? God puts himself into a position where,
this is
not positive at all. Respectfully, you're saying it's positive, but... That's
I'm saying which thing is positive?
The God approach, or the God-centered approach, where God is showing us what humanity is capable of.
The answer may be the human being doesn't want to demonstrate that, but it's not up to the human being. In other words, this book, flat out, is not written from a human being's perspective. It's not written to express, this is what we like and makes us feel good.
That's precisely my point. Yes. It's written from the perspective of God, Satan.
No.
God is Satan.
No.
You called it a game.
All right, Shana's waiting, so I'm gonna let Shana address this for a second.
If you're okay, what we're told, against your will you're born, against your will you die.
And if that isn't uplifting, I don't know what it is.
And if that's not, you can have assistance now.
Yes,
the point is that
that's true.
You have choices, but only within the limited sphere of what you perceive to be your life.
But that's the point. Because you've said it's within the limited sphere. Who creates that sphere? God has created that sphere. So it's wonderful that we have this choice that God decided on. Sort of a joke. God decided on our choice.
God gave us
the
power to
change this book. We're gone way beyond it.
Within the limited sphere of our choice. It's not often I quote General Franco, but he did say, there is no liberty except within order. And I think that's true. The only way to have a sense of freedom is to have a structure in which you can work out your freedom and perceive yourself as having choices to be made. If we had complete liberty, the world would be chaos.
This is very pace-up oriented. Janine has been waiting.
First of all, you mentioned God wants to know, or the game has to be played. But we do believe that God has foreknowledge, whatever that means, however...
Yeah, explain to me what that means, and then I'll explain how it works.
I'm saying it's almost more whether for man to reach a higher level or for the world to see a man reaching a higher level. More as a... same as we learned about Abraham, the test of Abraham.
Right.
Not for God to know, but for maybe man to be... spiritually.
So I think you have to address this on a couple of levels. First of all, and I think very importantly, the question of whether this book is meant to be a parable telling a story that didn't happen, or whether it's meant to record a particular moment in time. This actually was an event. If I take it as a parable, then it's clearly written pedagogically. It's meant to teach me something. As opposed to if it's just, this was a story, and it's an important story for people to be aware of. But even then, it also must be to teach me something, because why did it make it into Tanakh? You included it here because you wanted me to learn something. However, and I think this is a very important however, which I've stressed off and on through the book, the point that we are to learn from isn't necessarily the beginning. Meaning, this story takes a turn very early on. It begins as a trial of humanity. Let's see what they can do. And then Job turns it into a trial of God. And how can God run the world in this way, or not run the world in this way? And that may be what people are meant to learn from. I happen to think there's yet another level here, which I hinted at in the very beginning of the book, but as I said, comes to the fore at this stage, which I want to get to, which I think is actually more important than either of those two layers. So one, at some point we are going to get to that, and it's going to be in this hour. So just as a warning. But I think that getting caught up in the question of, I don't like cancer, and I don't like God putting this on people and forcing them to go through this, I don't think that necessarily addresses the point of the book. That's an overall, as Ralph said, that's a much bigger issue than how do I read the book of Job.
This is literature, so you can do anything. Well,
I'm not quite sure how to respond to that, so I'm not going to.
I think that's really important, because in today's writer, the ending, that last chapter where Job is restored.
Shh! Don't say that! They've been waiting for 58 weeks without spoilers.
That would never be written today. The book would end somewhere before that.
Potentially.
Because that's not how we write stories. Stories of mind with that sort of thing.
There's more to be said about that, but I'm going to hold my thought on that till chapter 42.
The whole point is that we're supposed to, you called it a game. Job was playing the game the way it was intended. Be a good person, do everything right, and you will be rewarded. And then the roof collapses on him. So, why was he tested? He was tested, he had obviously merited all those things. God said so. What needed to be tested?
As we said, it's whether the human being does this when he's not being rewarded.
But he was rewarded for having been good.
Right, and when you take that away...
God said to Satan, well, why would you take it away? That's my point.
And the answer is because the question is, how sincere are you?
Because God could have said to Satan, I'm rewarding him for already having been good.
Yeah.
He is good, he is rewarded, and it's justified. End of story.
But again, that's our point of saying this is what God cares about. He cares about demonstrating the sincerity and spiritual worth of humanity. You may not like that, but that's what the book is saying. You follow what I'm saying? That's the message of the book.
Yeah. Testing the morality of humanity.
Not morality, spiritual worth.
Spiritual worth, okay. But the point is that one has to assume that his spiritual worth was very high to have been rewarded by God in the way that he had been rewarded.
So
what does he need more testing for?
Because again, the question of someone's spiritual worth is not, does he do good things when he wins prizes, but does he do good things without any promise of a prize?
But if somebody is naturally pious, observant, devout, believing, and acts accordingly, and then is punished because he has to be tested further, I'm not sure what the point is.
And again, the point is, how will he do when he's not being rewarded? And understand what the disconnect is.
I'm just saying that you take a person walking down the street who's in the city of Toronto today, who is naturally pious and devout, and
I don't know what the phrase naturally pious and devout means.
He doesn't even reward.
Yeah, he just believes with all his heart and acts accordingly.
Why do you assume that that's true of Job?
Because God said so to the subcontinent.
No, he didn't. What God described was a pattern of behaviors that Job has exhibited. He has said nowhere that it's natural to him.
So behavior is no indication of character?
Correct. That's Satan's argument. Behavior is no indication of character because behavior may be a function of the reward he's been getting. It doesn't mean that he's a wonderful person. It means that he knows he has figured out the maze.
So Satan is the evil inclination.
I'm going to refer you back to the classes on that at the beginning. I'm not going there. Susan, and then we're going further because there's way too much to say.
I want to know from Job, are we also supposed to take that God is involved in our day-to-day life or not? Because before the Satan asked him, it appeared, I don't know if God was or wasn't, but through all what the people say and the talks that we've done so far, are we to understand that God is God's being, God's whatever you want to use, it gets involved in our day-to-day living, like so prayer has.
So I would separate that into three parts. It's a good question. Number one, the opening narrative, the opening story part of this clearly believes that God is involved in the day-to-day. That's very clear. Meaning, God is aware that Job is doing good things, and Job is being rewarded for the good things that he does. Whether it's through an angel, not through an angel, fundamentally God is involved in day-to-day. That's number one. Part two, the visitors. The visitors also clearly believe that God is involved on a day-to-day basis, watching what's going on, rewarding, punishing, planning, whatever it is that he's doing. Each of them has his own voice.
But that's
and then third,
not
nothing to do with it. She asked the question of what's being presented in the book. The answer is that the opening narrative believes God is involved day to day. The three visitors believe God is involved day to day. The third is Job himself. And Job, once he suffers in a way that doesn't fit to his mind what he should be receiving, he argues God is not involved in the day-to-day, or if God is involved, it's maliciously. That's the argument that he has been putting forth. And now we're going to see more of this, because while the debate is fun, we need to get a deeper understanding of this book. When God speaks...
You said God can be malicious.
No, I'm saying that's Job's argument.
Job's saying
that. What is God going to try to accomplish in chapters 38 to 41? He is not going to try to explain what happened. There will be nothing in chapters 38 to 41 in which God is going to say, this is why I did it. There will be no statement of, the Satan wanted to tell me that people are bad and I wanted to show that it's not true. There will be no statement of, Job, you were an evil person and you harmed people and that's why I did it. There will be no statement of, I harmed you in order for things to be better for you in the end. Nothing. Not the view of Elihu, not the view of Eliphaz, not the view of Bildad, not the view of Zophar, not the view of Job. Nobody is going to have God endorse their perspective directly. The only thing we will see is in the end, in chapter 42, God is going to condemn what the three visitors have said about it. That we will see. But nowhere in his speech to Job is he going to explain what happened. We will see an element of rebuke to Job for his criticism of how God runs the world. But I think that there is, as I said, a deeper level in all of this that has to be understood. And I referred to it at the very beginning, but I didn't have the same understanding of it that I have 58 weeks later. And that is that as I read this book, it is a love story. And very much like Shir HaShirim, like Song of Songs, but with a different angle. It's not a story of two peers who are in love. That's not what we're talking about. It's not even the story of a king who's involved with a peasant girl, which is what you can see a lot of in Song of Songs. What we're seeing here is the love of a peasant for the king, capital K, and the king for the peasant. And that's why the language here is not the romantic language of Shir HaShirim, of Song of Songs, but rather it's expressed in terms of awe and reverence and power and justice. It is not a romantic love. That's not what we're talking about. It's the peasant who admires and is loyal to the king. And the relationship begins in a very positive way. God is presented as the king valuing and loving his population. And that's very clear in the way he describes Job in chapter 1. Look at Job. He's wonderful. He's Tam V'Yashar. He's Yireh Elokim. This is what I want my citizens to be. This is what I want in my land. And I gave you a table in source number 2. We're not going to go through verse by verse in Song of Songs, but I gave you the references in Song of Songs where I see parallels. In chapter 4 there, we see God praise the Jewish people for their wonderful character. The peasant loves the king. There is love and there is admiration. It's seen in Song of Songs. I gave you an example of it in chapter 5, where the Jewish people praise God and describe God as being beautiful and wonderful and so on. And you see it in Job, where Job brings God gifts. He says, I'm going to bring, it was in chapter 1, sentence 5, I'm going to bring God gifts. This, again, this is not about love per se, love in the way we think of it, love between two people. This is the peasant looking at his king and saying, my king is wonderful. That's the way the book starts. And Job will continue to repeat that loyalty throughout the book, as we'll see. We've already seen in the book, but we'll see in this outline. But then you get into conflict. In Shir HaShirim, in Song of Songs, the conflict comes about when the Jew, the woman, lets God down. God, the king, the beloved, comes knocking at the door And the response is, oh, I can't get out of bed, I already bathed, I already took off my shoes, I can't do it. That's what creates the conflict there, the rupture in the relationship. In Job, it's the other way around. It's the king who lets down the peasant. Job declares repeatedly in the book, I have been righteous. God has harmed me in ways that don't match my deeds and frankly don't match my overall significance. I'm a little nothing. Why is he paying so much attention to me? Why is he hurting me? Wicked people thrive and they're not punished. If this is the way the relationship is going to work, better that he should leave me alone. I don't want to be his citizen anymore. I don't want to be part of God's country. So that in Shirashirim's Song of Songs, we are the ones who let down God. In Job, God is the one who lets us, in the form of Job, down. And in Job, the Jew, and in Shirashirim, frankly, in Song of Songs, the Jew ultimately goes looking for God. We say, let me find God. So in Shirashirim, in Song of Songs, they get up and say, we're going to go circle through the city trying to find our beloved. And Job goes looking for God. He has this overwhelming desire to communicate with the God who has let him down. And he complains repeatedly, as Elihu picked up on. He says, God isn't going to communicate with me. God isn't going to respond to my demands for justice. In Shirashirim, in Song of Songs, and this was really what triggered it for me. This is what I really understood. In Song of Songs, as he goes, as the beloved goes looking for her beloved, goes looking for God, she encounters people in the city, the guards, and the guards beat her up and say, "What is this? What are you doing out here? Who are you looking for?" And to Job, it's the visitors who are beating him up, who are saying, "You've been rotten. You have no idea about the king. You have no idea about God at all," and in both cases, we, represented either by the girl in Song of Songs or Job in the book of Job, express outrage at those who are opposing us. So that in Shirashirim, in Song of Songs, he says, no, you're maligning my beloved. Let me explain my beloved to you. And you get this whole beautiful description of how the wonders of God. And Job himself, repeatedly in the book, chapter 13, again in chapter 26, says, you're presenting a false image of who God is. You're idolatrous. That's not who God is. Let me tell you who God is. And I can describe the wonders of God. And in fact, Job comes to the defense of God against the visitors. He says, what you're saying is all wrong. And because the conflicts and the relationships are different, the resolutions in the books are also different. Because in Song of Songs, the resolution, I think, is of reunion. Frankly, it's unclear exactly where this happens in Song of Songs, because the end of Song of Songs is a very difficult ending. But it's supposed to be resolution. We were together. We let God down. We went looking for God. We had to battle others along the way. And ultimately, we are reunited with God. That's your Shir HaShirim, your Song of Songs narrative. In Job, we were together. God let me down. I went looking for God. I defended my understanding of God. And the resolution is a recognition that the relationship between God and Job is not going to be a close, intimate relationship. It's going to be one of a distant king. In other words, the resolution in Job is not a happy resolution. It's not, you know, God and I were best buddies in the beginning and we're going to be best buddies at the end. It's actually a recognition that he's the king and I am as far from being king as you could possibly be. And therefore, I'm not going to understand why he let me down. It's effectively acceptance rather than reunion. Job's experience, frankly, is a perfect example of what human beings go through. In other words, the human being who has questions and wants to know why did God do this and why didn't God do that, ultimately either lives a life of anger, looking for God or being critical of God, or comes to the acceptance that Job is going to come to in the end, in which he's going to say, you know, God is just way out there, and there's nothing for me to understand. There will be communication. He's going to get a message from God. But the communication only serves to explain the gap between them that prevents anything closer than that. However, one last point. In the end, God is going to give Job gifts. Sorry, I'm blowing the ending now. Which demonstrate the love that's there. Even though he has taken so much from him, and Job's not getting back what he lost, no matter how much you give him, it's not going to change the fact that he lost his family. We have to talk about that when we get to chapter 42. But what God does do is say, within the context of this relationship, me being king way out there, you being lowly peasant, there can still be affection. And there can still be a bond, and I can still be associated in some sense with you. And so what we're going to see in God's speeches in chapters 38 to 41 is not a personal communication, but rather it's an attempt to explain to Job why there can't be personal communication. And then we'll see how Job responds to it. Susan and then Moshe.
Isn't there also the third, you said there were three, you know, distant from God, loving God. But isn't there a third that's becoming an atheist and saying, I just can't believe in you?
Right, not within the context of this book. The book, every character in this book accepts the idea that God is there. In the same way that we asked the question, actually you asked the question, I think, early on, of why doesn't he ever just commit suicide? Right, he complains, you did ask, why is it that he complains bitterly and he says, I wish I would die, but he doesn't actually do it. There are certain rules, so to speak, by which this book is playing, and that's one of them, that suicide isn't on the table, and another one is that there is a God. There's no one in the book who's willing to challenge that. Moshe.
I've got a very short response to you. I don't think what you're describing is love at all. There's two words for it, and it's very current words. It's called Oslo Syndrome. That's all it is.
What is
Oslo Syndrome.
Oslo. Do you mean Oslo or Stockholm?
Stockholm. Yeah, right, Oslo.
Stockholm. Right. Stockholm. Scandinavia, it's all the same. You're an American like me.
I think that's what I think.
So the question of, hang on, because what you said was short, but it requires a real answer. The question of, is God's relationship abusive, is a fundamental question in its own right. But from the book's perspective, and from the response that God is going to give, the answer will be, you think it's abuse because of where you sit. But if you were on my throne, you would understand things differently. That will be the way that God will respond to you.
No, I'll tell you why it's abuse. It's abuse because there's something I didn't actually see at all till today, and considering I missed 3/4 of the book, that doesn't mean much. But you mentioned it. God tests Job with respect to God. It's not a test, how does Job relate to other human beings? Which,
correct.
Which our choice should be that. That is to say, we have a hand in that.
But that's being
we have a hand.
We talked about that actually a little while back. We said that the traits that God, when we talked after chapter 31, when we talked about what the test of Job was, we said that Satan did not pick up on that, on his relations with other people. He specifically picked up on the relationship with God. He didn't want to test him about being Tam V'Yashar wasn't interesting to Satan. Yirei Elokim was interesting to Satan.
That's
true. Sorry, one second. Before we get up to chapter 38, I want to make sure to answer questions, but I want to see how many questions we're working with. We've got Rita, we've got Paul. Okay, Paul, go ahead, and then Rita.
I just want to say briefly that you did a brilliant comparison between Shirshim and Eel, but in the final analysis, based on what you're saying, isn't the real comparison with Kohelet?
So the problem with Kohelet is that it has neither beginning nor end.
Right.
But yes, I agree with you that it's also a search for God.
Right.
Yes.
But ultimately, the answer is the same. You're not going to understand. So just do what you're supposed to do and what you're told to do. And the meaning will become apparent to you perhaps at some point. But it seems to me that the conclusion, the philosophical conclusion, the theological conclusion of both is the same.
So I can see similarities in the conclusion, but I would note that whereas Job spends its entire time trying to analyze God, Kohelet, Ecclesiastes, spends its entire time trying to analyze man. There's very little of God in the book. It's much more, God is there and is mentioned and so on, but much more of the book is where will human beings find meaning and value.
But basically, Kohelet is still trying to figure out what makes sense in this world, given the presence of God and the judgment of God, in the way that Job does. Only the difference is the focus or the perspective.
Maybe. And wisdom literature as a whole will have an interest in this question.
Right. And a lack of...
Right.
Rita.
You said there's no personal communication?
No, there is communication, but it's not personal. When I say it's not personal, what I mean is there will be nothing in God's speeches that speaks of what Job has experienced. There will be not... In other words, it's as though you had received a robocall. This speech God is going to give could have been given to anybody. It isn't about Job and his life and his questions. It's, here's a little bit of God's job description. And now you will understand why you ain't it. That's more or less,
We believe that we communicate with God through prayer and he answers our prayer, so that's personal.
I'm talking only within the context of Job. I'm not going anywhere beyond that. Shana.
I had the pleasure of being at the Shmat a number of years ago with Rabbi Hengen, based in Pasadena. If I remember correctly, it's not the content; it's the fact of the answer that is important.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's part of it. Certainly, the fact that God will make a statement by communicating it. I wouldn't agree that we would disregard the substance of it, but I do think the fact that he's going to speak is important because it is a response to his statement that God doesn't communicate. So, in that sense, God's saying, "Ha, here I am. I do communicate. Find meaning in it." So introducing the first speech, which is going to be chapters 38 and 39. Because God is going to speak to Job, and then God's going to demand an answer from Job. Job's going to sort of answer, and then God is going to give a second speech. So, what you're going to see here in these two chapters, 38 and 39, is incredibly dramatic, gorgeous, majestic imagery. It's going to make Elihu look like a punk kid, basically. Elihu, who wanted to describe the grandeur of God with the storm, has nothing on what's going to show up here. We're not going to go into great depth in terms of the language of the passages because I do want to finish this book in early June. So we're not going to spend a lot of time on it, but we are going to look at it to some extent because you can't not. I gave you an outline in number 3 of the chapter so you can see it's going to start with a 3-verse introduction, an important 3-verse introduction. Then it's going to talk about the founding of the world. World meaning universe. World, our world, world, universe. Knowledge of the world and what goes on. Power over the storm and power over the beasts, which is going to be the bulk, as you see, the end of chapter 38 and all of chapter 39 is going to be about divine power over the beasts. The themes are the gap between God and man, such that man cannot understand what God does. You don't understand anything about running the world. You don't have the power to run the world. And what you barely see is the role of human affairs at all here. You will see very little about human beings. God is going to emphasize how he created the universe, all the different elements of our world, and how he controls the animals. We're not going to see God talk about what he does to people. It's not there. And it really struck me, and then I saw what Newsom said about it, which highlighted it as well. Take a look at number 4, where I brought you her statement about it. I was happy to see it wasn't just me who was bothered by it. She writes, as pointed out in the discussion of chapters 29 to 31, which were, you have to go back that far to find it, those were Job's last speeches. Job's rhetoric repeatedly inscribes God into his speech as warrant and model for his conduct and his moral world. That was where Job described his arc, where Job said, things were wonderful for me, then I came to this terrible suffering, and now I am lowly and no one respects me, and even though I never, ever, ever did anything wrong. And he went through his whole list of all the things he had never done wrong, emphasizing the importance of his good conduct. So Job talks about God as the basis for his conduct. Divine and human beings occupy the same familiar territory. By contrast, the rhetorical questions addressed to Job by God, such as, where were you when I created the world? Can you do this? Do you know that? Eliminate him from presence, participation, or knowledge of the foundation and maintenance of the cosmos, even as they address him. In other words, what God is doing is he's saying we operate in two entirely different playing fields. There is no way that you can understand what's going on. It's out of your experience and out of your abilities. She has more to say about this, but I wanted to bring that in particular. So what we're going to contemplate here as we read through this is, number one, does this answer Job's questions? Number two, does this speech from God agree with the visitors? Does it agree with Job? And number three, now that Job has heard from God, what do you think he's going to say in response? So that's what I want to think about as we go through it. And we start with verses 1 to 3. Vayan Hashem, if you're using the Stone Tanakh, it's page 1671. Vayan Hashem es Yov min ha-sa'ara vayomar, which is usually read as God answered or declared to Job from the whirlwind. Sa'ara doesn't have to mean a whirlwind. It's a storm, a mighty wind, but everyone translates it as whirlwind.
Except Korin.
Except Korin. No kidding. What do they do?
Storm.
Okay. I thought it was an automatic thing. Like you had to render Sa'ara as a whirlwind. The
storm wind.
Tempest. Huh. Iconoclast.
It says storm wind.
Storm wind. Okay. It's a mighty wind, however you slice it. The Vayomar, and he declared, I want to just read the introduction and then come back to the image of this whirlwind. Mize machshich etza b'milin b'lidas. Who is this who darkens counsel with words without understanding? I'm going to come back to this. There's a lot to say here. But Pasuk Gimel, sentence 3. Ezor na chegever chalatzecha. Gird yourself like a man, or gever can be like a warrior. V'esh alcha, I'm going to ask you questions. V'hodieni, and you are going to answer me. The word na there decidedly does not mean please. It means now in sentence 3. When it says ezor na, the word na is sometimes rendered as please. This is not a please. God does not say please in this speech. That's just not who he is. So going back to the beginning of this, first of all, vayan. The word vayan often means to declare, and generally that's the way it was taken with each of the speeches we saw until now. But here you know it means respond. How do you know it means respond? Go back to any of the chapters that started with the word vayan and tell me the difference between each of those sentences and the one here. Sorry? Something else.
Et
Iyov. There's a target. There's an object. Right. In all the other ones, it was vayan, fill in the blank. Vayan Iyov. Vayan Eliphaz. Vayan Bildad. But that was it. There was no recipient. It was, and he spoke, and he declared. Here it's, he talked to Job. That means Vayan here means that he answered, which is important, because that's what Job has been asking for all along. He's asking God to answer him. But there's this whirlwind, or storm wind, or tempest, or whatever this is. And not only that, it comes with a definite object. It's not min sa'ara, from a whirlwind. Min ha sa'ara, from the whirlwind. So what exactly does that mean? There are, surprise, multiple ways to take this. Take a look at source number 5, which is Ralbag. Ralbag says, Yuchas zemar el ha sa'ara. He says, this vision is associated with the whirlwind. He says prophets always have something that interrupts between them and the source of the prophecy because they're physical. You can't fully comprehend the message that's being sent. And this is the idea of the aspaklaria hameira, the idea that there's a cloudier or more clear lens depending on the level of the prophet. So he says the whirlwind expresses simply that Job can't see inside. It's something that obscures so that Job will not be able to perceive it. And that's one approach. However, the general trend among the sages was to say this actually refers to a specific se'ara, a specific whirlwind, a specific storm wind. Go back to chapter 9, sentence 17, please. This was a complaint of Job. It is found on page 1633 at the top. Chapter 9, sentence 17. Job said, Asher bis'ara yishufeni. He shattered me in a tempest, or in a whirlwind, or in a storm, or whatever, again, whatever translations you want to put it. But the word is se'ara. It's the same word. Don't get hung up in one being with a sin and one being with a samach. They're the same. They're the same. So Job said, God shattered me with a storm. So two different approaches in Midrash. One in source 6, one in source 7. Source 6 says, this is a Midrash, an early Midrash, it's the Mechilta. When God struck Job, he struck him from the whirlwind, as Job himself said in the verse we just read. And when God healed him, he only did it also from the whirlwind, as we see here. So this is God harmed him with a whirlwind, and now the healing is going to begin, so that will be with the whirlwind, and therefore it's the whirlwind, as in the same thing was the source for the harm, as well as the reunion in the end. It's a parallelism. And then there's a third approach which the Talmud brings in source number 7. I'm going to say it outside of the text, because the text itself is a little bit hard to parse. Job, the Talmud says, alleges that God has gotten confused between him and somebody else. They take chapter 9, sentence 17, to mean that he claimed that God got confused. There was a storm, and he confused him for somebody else, and Eov became Oyev. Right? Eov, Job, Oyev, enemy. The two words being very similar. And so what God is doing here is saying, I don't get confused. You can't make such an allegation. Yes.
Yeah, I just want to say there's in one of the Navi, it says God is not in the whirlwind.
Ah, so good. I'm getting there.
He's a still small voice.
Mm-hmm.
So this says he is in the whirlwind. I just want to know how you reconcile.
Right. So I actually had that. I was going to get to it later, but yes, I think that the key element here of God speaking to Job with that, and in Malachim, where we're told God does not, it's Eliyahu, that, you know, the still small voice, and he doesn't come to God in it, is that each prophetic experience is unique to the prophet. It wasn't the statement of God is never in the whirlwind, but this isn't the message for you, Eliyahu, right now. But I'm going to come back to that. That's something I wanted to get to later. So there's also, for those who read the Hebrew, the min ha-se'ara is written all as one word, but I haven't seen anybody provide that with a layer of meaning beyond this is the way the scribes did it. There has to be a reason for compounding it, but I don't know what the reason is. So he says to Job, from the whirlwind, whether that means from something Job cannot understand, like Ralbag, or whether it means from that same force that harmed Job before, God now comes to heal him. You can read this either way. I think both messages are important. He comes to Job and he says, who is this who darkens counsel with his words without understanding? What is he saying to him?
You don't know what you're talking about.
What does it mean to darken counsel?
The opposite of clear.
But what is the counsel? What is the counsel that he is darkening? The simple meaning is Right. But the simple meaning is it's talking about Job's own speech. You offer obscure counsel, Job, you don't know what you're talking about. Right? That's the simple approach. However, the commentators suggest that it's actually you darkened my counsel. God's counsel. Either, if you take a look at source number 8, Mitzudat David, Rabbi David Altshuler, says, you are claiming that I run the world poorly, Job. You are darkening my counsel. You claim that my counsel is dark and foolish with your words that don't understand anything. That's one approach. Rashi says, it's the counsel God gave to the Satan in the beginning of the book. Do you remember after chapter 31 when we discussed the question of whether Job passed or failed the test? And we said you could read it either way? Right? We said the test was a test of loyalty, fitting with the theme of the book about the loyalty to the king. It's a test fundamentally of will he remain loyal to God? And we said you could answer that question either way. On the one hand, he remained loyal to God in the sense that he kept insisting, God, you don't understand how God works. I am still loyal to God. I act righteously. I just want to know what in the world is going on. And then on the other hand, he declared that God was not running the universe in a just way. So you could read him either way. Rashi here says that Job failed the test. That he's now being rebuked. Take a look at number 9. He says, Mizehu machshich etzam mekakel b'milim uberov devarim. Who is this who darkens counsel and corrupts with words and long speeches? Rashi's also been reading the book. Shekasavti ish tam v'yashar b'tchilat ha-sefer. I said, he's complete and he's righteous. Kelachosh mi'alav, placing my name upon him. And look at him, he is rejecting that. So the response of Rashi is that no, Job actually is clouding God's comments about him. God said nice things about him, and now he has not lived up to it. Job is going to respond to this line in chapter 42. So you have to hang on to this sentence. But Job is going to respond to this line. Don't forget it. But he says, you cloud counsel, whether that means you present confused ideas or whether that means you are clouding my counsel. Billy Das, without any understanding. And so he says, Ezorna ki gever chalotzecha. He says, fight like a man. He says, I want you to gird yourself like a gever. And again, gever could mean male, gever could mean warrior. Don't get hung up on the image. But I'm going to ask you questions, Job, which I think has a certain irony to it, because Job said all along, Dan Mikra points this out, Job said all along, God would never let me actually debate with him. Right? That was one of Job's principal points. He said, God will intimidate me, he's going to frighten me, he'll take away my strength. And God says, no. We're going to do this right. I'm going to talk, and you're going to answer my questions, Job. So, you're getting your day in court just like you asked. Debbie?
So, do we assume that God is talking to the general congregation, all his four friends, not friends?
Yes.
So you could be a bigger you, possibly.
Except that he began by saying he answered Job.
Oh, right, sorry.
So yeah, I think they're all present and listening.
I mean, who is you who gives murky counsel? That could refer absolutely to his comfort.
Oh, he has better things to say to them. Don't you worry. Yeah, no, there's more coming for them. Okay, so that is the introduction. We still have a few minutes, or don't, because we spent time at the beginning talking about what we're doing next year. Oh, no, we don't. Okay, so we're going to have to pick up from this, God willing, next week. But next week I really want to get through 38 and 39, because we have a lot going on here. But you know, what I hope people take away from it, and the discussion in the beginning notwithstanding about whether you like the message that is being given, is that this is a book about the search for God. That's what you're really seeing here. Just as Shir HaShirim, the Song of Songs, is on a different level, because there it's about this love relationship, and here it's much more king-peasant. And there it's about us letting God down, and here it's about God letting Job down. But fundamentally, it's about a search for God. That's really what this is. And then the response that God is going to give about whether there can even be such a search at all. Thank you.